We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls. This hour, Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Asian carp were imported into the U.S. for use in aquaculture. But in the 80s, they escaped into the wild. They're now found in large numbers in the Mississippi and Illinois river systems. And there are some scientists who worry that these fish will eventually find their way into the Great Lakes and cause a lot of harm to the ecosystem of the lakes. Others suggest, well, maybe you ought to think a little bit more carefully about this problem and decide whether, in fact, it is a problem or not. In this part of the show, we'll talk certainly about the Asian carp. That's a good case study for us. But we want to try to talk a little bit more generally about how it is we assess the threat posed by invasive introduced species. And we have two guests with us. Joining us by telephone, Reuben Keller. He's the Henry Chandler Cowles Lecturer in Environmental Studies at the University of Chicago. He is a community ecologist who is interested on the impacts and management of invasive species. He's also had research positions elsewhere, University of Cambridge, at Notre Dame, and he's worked extensively with a number of management agencies, including City of Chicago, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, and also the U.S. National Invasive Species Council. He's particularly interested in how you incorporate invasive species science into management programs. So here in studio with me, we have Glenn Sandford. He's an environmental writer. His background is in urban and regional planning, and he is interested in environmental issues. And in fact, he has a book that is coming out soon. It's an environmental history of the Adirondacks in New York. That'll be published next year. He's also now working on a book about the controversy surrounding the Asian carp. And he's here in the studio, and we're glad that we can have both of them to have some conversation on this subject. Questions are welcome, as always. If you're listening in and you'd like to call in, the number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We also have an email. The address is a little complicated, but it's WILL-Illinois. Let me try that again. It's Will Talk, essentially. It's WILL-talk at illinois.edu. We just can't make it simple. Anyway, that's what it is. If you want to write in and if you want to call, you're certainly welcome to do that. And here on the telephone, Dr. Keller, hello.
Hi, David.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. And Glenn Sandford, who is also a doctor. Dr. Sandford, hey, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Let me talk first here with Reuben Keller. And just there's been a fair amount of coverage in the news, obviously, of Asian carp. It sort of comes and goes as a story. But at least when the stories that we read, there is a suggestion that there is this serious threat. That they have been moving up from the south, up the Mississippi, and that there's this real worry about what would happen if they should, in substantial numbers, they should get into the Great Lakes. And there is basically one way we think that they'll do that, and so people have been talking about setting up various kinds of barriers to prevent that. Just give us what's the thumbnail sketch? What should people know as we go into talking about this? What should they know about the Asian carp?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, they've been in the Mississippi River system for several decades now. They were originally introduced for aquaculture facilities in the southern U.S. They escaped into the Mississippi, and we've been watching them move north for at least 20, 30 years. So the fact that they're now knocking on the door of the Great Lakes is no surprise. We've seen this coming. People are extremely concerned about what impacts they would have if they actually reach the Great Lakes. And if we look at the impacts that they're having in the Mississippi River, and some of the most visible of those are the silver carp, which is one of the species that we're concerned about, which has this incredible jumping behavior. And anyone who's been watching the news recently or reading the newspapers will have seen these very arresting pictures of hundreds and sometimes thousands of carp leaping out of the water. The concerns are that those impacts would also move into the Great Lakes if the fish do. Now, this is a really difficult thing to assess. As a community ecologist, I'm really interested in how species move into new communities of organisms and the sorts of impacts that they have when they arrive. So the question of how might Asian carp integrate themselves into the Great Lakes ecosystem is really interesting. I don't think that there's a really clear answer. These questions are always really difficult. In particular, the Asian carp are an incredibly adaptable species. And over the history of their invasions worldwide, ecologists have constantly been surprised to discover that they can do new things, things that they've never done before. So it's really hard to just look at their history of invasion worldwide and then to make an assessment of what they're likely to do in the Great Lakes, because one aspect of their invasion history is that they surprise us.
Well, then is the, and here I'll turn just in a second to Glenn and ask him to talk about this, but then is the issue here that we have we been overstating the potential problem, or is it that we really don't know, so we can't really say whether this is going to be a problem or not?
It depends on who the we is when you say we've been overstating the problem. I think that certainly some of the people have overstated the potential impacts that Asian carp could have to the Great Lakes. For example, we've seen people who are particularly interested in fisheries in the Great Lakes claim that the $7 billion commercial fishery in the Great Lakes could be destroyed. I don't think that's going to happen. But we've had other people say that they really aren't going to cause any impacts in the Great Lakes. And I also don't think that's going to happen. We certainly know that there are parts of the Great Lakes. There are many other rivers that flow into the Great Lakes that would likely provide very good habitat for Asian carp if they can get to them. So if Asian carp reach the Great Lakes, if they get to those rivers, we should be really concerned about the impacts that they'll have. And likewise for areas like Green Bay and perhaps Lake Erie as well, are regions that Asian carp seem to be better adapted to.
Well, pardon me, you were about to round out your thought there,
yeah.
So go ahead.
So I think the answer is that there's only one way to find out exactly what impacts they'll have in the Great Lakes, and that's to let them arrive. But the problem is, if they do arrive, they could have really nasty impacts, and there are good reasons to believe they might have nasty impacts. And at that point, we've lost our ability to get rid of them, which argues for an approach based on precaution.
Okay. Well, now here I'll turn to my guest in the studio here, Glenn Sandiford, and particularly I'm interested because I noted that you were writing a book that you say is about the Asian carp controversy. And I suppose there the question is, what is the controversy exactly?
That's a great question. I'd just like to build on what Ruben was saying there. The controversy is more than what's going on in Chicago and the Great Lakes, for example. And for this, I would credit my own students who took a class with me this semester. For one assignment, they went out and interviewed people who we might term as stakeholders in the Asian carp controversy. And one thing that they discovered was that, or lost in the controversy of the major headlines, is these fish have already had impacts in river communities. Spring Lake, for example, they have annual fishing tournaments for various native species, and they feel that the fishes are declining in size and in abundance. And the tournament as a result, and the harvest from the tournament is declining. And then, of course, also on the river, and I think this is really what propelled this to become such a newsworthy issue, was the silver carp jumping out. They're not just jumping. They're not just fun things to watch on YouTube. They're actually hurting people. People have had broken jaws and broken noses. They've had to go to hospital, have had to be rescued. Also, we need to remember in this, these fish have only been here 30 years. So I think we've still got a long way to go before we get a sense for the long-term impacts of these fish. Mm-hmm. In talking to biologists working on the Illinois River, they're already seeing signs that the native species are becoming skinnier. And that suggests that the Asian carp, which we need to remember are filter feeders, they're not competing or predating directly on native species, but they're filter feeders. And as a result of that trait or characteristic, they may be starving out some of the native species. So in answer to your question, the controversy is much bigger than Chicago. It's regional and possibly, as we've seen with zebra mussels, which started out in the Great Lakes but which are now in California, this may become a national issue as they spread, if indeed they spread mm-hmm. into the Great Lakes. So the controversy, it depends on your perspective. Yeah.
And just to underline one thing, just to make sure people understand, because I think this was something that I learned in the process of looking at the subject, that on one hand, we hear about these carp being big, aggressive, very hungry fish. But the threat that they pose, it's not that they're going to eat up all the other fish. They're going to eat the food that those other fish eat. So and they're capable of apparently eating a tremendous amount. So what they're doing is they're taking a big chunk out of the available food supply for other fish. So it's an issue. It's, as you say, it's not about direct predation, but it's about competition, say between species, and the fact that if the carp eat up all the food, then for the other fish, there's going to be less for them to eat. So eventually, they're going to waste away. Maybe that's being a little bit extreme, but that's sort of the idea.
That's correct, yeah. Ruben can certainly talk to this better than I can, but it's the Asian carp, clarifying that there are four species, and that the two that we're primarily interested in here is the bighead carp and the silver carp are both filter feeders. And they've been likened often to vacuum cleaners. They're basically underwater vacuum cleaners. Reports that they grow 40% or eat 40% of their weight every day. That's been exaggerated a bit, but nonetheless, they do eat a lot of these phytoplankton every day. And having been on the river as recently as a month ago and seen these fish flying into the boat, they can grow to a substantial size. So yes, they're going to eat a lot of food. And it's hard to believe that they aren't, as a result of that diet, the amount that they eat and their abundance, their sheer abundance, that they're not going to impact native species and native local ecosystems in some way.
Yeah. And this behavior, that actually explains why it is they were brought into the United States in the first place. They were brought in to be incorporated into aquaculture setups, not so much as being a food fish, although they can be a food fish, but that they were a cleanup. They would put them in the tanks with the other fish, and they could, as you say, like the vacuum cleaner, they would go around and they would scoop up the stuff that you wanted to get rid of.
That's correct. That was how they were presented or rationalized as these fish are worthy of trying as aquaculture species. But if you read the assessments from the 1950s and 60s, their food value, because they are utilized as food fish in other parts of the world, that food value was also not exaggerated, but certainly mentioned and hyped.
I guess there are some people who say they are pretty good to eat. Now, I've never had the experience myself, but I think there are people who make the argument that's one way you can deal with the carp is to eat them.
Yes, and that certainly depends on one's perspective. That's maybe where my own background comes in. I, as an environmental historian, previously studied the common carp, which was introduced in the 1870s and 1880s, and they started out as a fish that was very positively received and marketed to the American population. But within 20 years, they were despised, and they were attracting literally the same kind of headlines in the late 19th century that the Asian carp are generating today, in the Chicago Tribune and in the New York Times. And the response to that was, well, the common carp are here now, so let's try and market them. We thought they were good eating, but maybe it's just a question of educating the American palate. Well, here we are 125 years later, and to the best of my knowledge, common carp are generally not regarded as a fine dining fish.
Well, let me reintroduce the guests that we have here for this part of Focus. Here in studio with me is Glenn Sandifert. He's an environmental writer, has a PhD in urban and regional planning from the University of Illinois. In fact, he just taught a course on the Asian carp here at the university in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, and he's working on a book about the Asian carp and some of the controversy that surrounds it. Also joining us by telephone is Reuben Keller. He's a lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Chicago. He's a community ecologist and is particularly interested in the impact and management of invasive species. Let me go back to Reuben Keller. I just hear anything in particular in what Glenn said here in the last little bit that you'd want to comment on or expand on?
I'll just give a little bit more detail about why we should be particularly concerned about the impacts of filter feeders coming into ecosystems like the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes. So at the very bottom of the food chain, we have basically algae. These are aquatic plants, and they're the things that make life out of sunlight and basic nutrients. And everything else in the food chain relies on them. So their energy gets moved up to the organisms that eat the algae, to which are normally small animals floating around in the water column, and then to small fish, and then to large fish. So if you have something like the Asian carp, a very efficient filter feeder that comes in, it essentially cuts off the bottom of that food chain. So you get the production of algae, but then all of the energy produced can end up in the filter feeder, in this case the Asian carp. So none of that energy is available for the rest of the food chain. And because Asian carp grow very, very quickly, they very quickly achieve what we call a size refuge. That is, they get too large for other fish to eat them. So they become something like an energy dead end. All of the energy that's produced in the system goes into the Asian carp, and it just stays there. It doesn't get transferred to other organisms.
I want to bring in the caller we have here who's been waiting patiently over in Belgium in Vermilion County, and this is line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to all of you. I was wondering if you might want to really broaden the issue just a little bit. Since we're speaking of invasive species, there have been several around and several that we actually have promoted very, very strongly. If you want to consider something like soybeans and corn, which have taken over vast quantities of the available space for other animals. And then we're talking about switchgrass. Like you said, the zebra mussel, the Asian carp, maybe we need to find a way to use it for something else, grind it up and put it back on the fields, make a bounty for it. But we've introduced lots of species that have taken over a lot of the environment that, you know, every bit this much of a problem when you look at the natural sphere.
Yeah, go ahead, Reuben.
This is absolutely true, and I think this is a really important point to make, and it's a point that I try to make whenever I'm talking about this. Asian carp are just one species. They're the latest and greatest. They're the one that's getting all the headlines at the moment, but they are just one species. They're only one part of the invasive species problem that we're constantly dealing with in this country and that everyone else is dealing with around the world. And the reason that we have these invasive species is basically because we've globalized. As we've connected societies in Illinois, for example, to all sorts of other societies around the globe, we begin to trade with them. And when we trade, we both trade in actual species. So in the case of Asian carp, we identified that Asian carp was a species that we wanted to have in the United States in the aquaculture facilities, and we were able to bring it in. But we also accidentally move around a lot of species. And this happens in the Great Lakes a lot, for example, with invasive species coming in the ballast water of ships. These are species that are introduced, become established, and that have very large impacts, but that we never said we wanted those species. It's just that the way we do business, the way that we run the shipping industry, for example, leads to the introductions of those species. So the caller is absolutely correct. Asian carp is just one small part of this much larger problem. And once we get species here, we have to try and decide what to do with them. Now, my particular expertise is in freshwater ecosystems. And as I mentioned earlier, once a species becomes invasive in a lake or in a river, there's generally very little that we can do about it. We have the technology to kill everything in freshwater ecosystems. But we don't really have the technology to kill individual species. And usually the option of killing everything is not feasible. We don't want to kill off all the native species, for example, so that we can get at one of the invaders. So the best management for aquatic species in terms of invasiveness is to keep out those species that are most likely to become invasive. So the way that might work is that it would have been great if prior to introducing Asian carp into the United States, there had been some sort of intensive study into the likelihood that they would have first of all escaped and then become abundant in the Mississippi River and then moved throughout the Mississippi and perhaps into the Great Lakes. And I think that if that study had been done, the history of invasions of this species and the fact that we know how they feed, we know that they have these impacts on the food web, would have led people to say, actually, the costs of this species, the potential costs of this species if it escapes, are so great that they completely outweigh the potential benefits to this really quite limited aquaculture industry in the South. So for aquatic species, the best management is to try and keep them out. For terrestrial species, it can be a little different. We tend to have a few more options available, and the caller mentioned things like bounty, for animals we can have a bounty, for plants we can go out and pull them, and we tend to have a much broader range of pesticides and herbicides available. But still, even in terrestrial systems, our record of really controlling invasive species is not very good. Again, the best thing that we can do is try to prevent them from arriving.
Well, let me turn to Glenn Sandiford here, and I don't know if you can comment on that any further, but I am interested in this, asking, you know, given that we've seen these stories play out before, as Reuben Keller explained, you know, we know cases where someone has deliberately brought something that was non-native in, seemingly for a good reason, that turned out to be a problem. And then there are cases where, without anybody's deliberate action, non-native species have been introduced, and those two things the circumstances are different. But the question for both of them is, have we learned anything by having studied that, so that we're not still doing the same stuff that's going to then end up with new invasive species coming in?
Oh, difficult question there, a great question. First of all, if I could just follow up a little bit on what Ruben was saying to the gentleman who called, which was a great question. One thing Ruben, I think, was trying to make a distinction there between was introduced species versus invasive species. And I guess, guessing that perhaps the caller has an interest in agriculture, I guess the analogy I would use there is that corn, soybean, and most of the crops that we have, that we grow and harvest, are controllable. If they were to be left to run amok, as it were, there'd be all kinds of native plants that'd be competing with them. So, for a farmer, though, a thistle, for example, might be more akin to the Asian carp. Thistles were very unpopular. They came in crops in the 19th century. They came in crop seeds, rather. And then they became a problem because they became invasive. And the farmers didn't want them mixing with their crops. And the problem with the thistle was it was not controllable. It had its own, I wouldn't say ideas, but it took a life of its own, as it were. And that's the problem with species like the Asian carp, particularly aquatic species. They're much harder to control. So again, there's a difference between introduced species and invasive species. I also want to emphasize that the people who are bringing in these species, whether it's for farming or whether it's for aquaculture, they're well-meaning people. Sometimes they've been demonized, and we need to be careful of that. These are well-meaning people who are trying to generally feed people, provide food for people. Have we learned anything from this experience? I guess that's one of the questions I have at the back of my mind as I follow the Asian carp controversy. Right now, everybody's kind of in a standoff mode. We're seeing, have the Asian carp got into the Great Lakes? And if so, and if not, well, can we prevent them, and or what can we do in the Illinois River, Mississippi River? And if they are getting into the Great Lakes, then we're just going to have to wait and see what happens. The fact that so many meetings are occurring, there's so much debate going on, the fact that the White House appointed an Asian carp czar, which I think is unheard of for an invasive species, suggests that we are really looking at this in a different light for the first time. I certainly feel that way. The headlines, no, they're nothing new, but I think there's an undercurrent of seriousness that the states, as reflected in the lawsuits that they've filed on this issue, are taking this more seriously. And down the road, I think there will be some legal ramifications coming out of this.
All right. Let's take another caller here. Someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Couple questions and a comment. First of all, I know that several people are trying to develop recipes and put Asian carp on restaurant menus. And my only fear about that is that what if we create a market for it and people want to start and continue farming it again? And then are there measures in place to test species that are brought in on purpose? And are there measures in place to prevent species coming in by accident? And I'll hang up and listen online.
Okay. Well, those are three really. We could probably talk for some time about each of those three things. I guess we can try to take them in the order. What about the issue is that if everybody decides, hey, these are good eaten, that then someone will decide, well, that we could go into aquaculture and we could actually raise them deliberately, and then we'd have an even bigger problem.
Okay, I'll try tackling that one first. I think Ruben is much better qualified to tackle the second question. Again, that's a very difficult question to answer about the marketability of these fish, because you're talking about people's livelihoods. There are fishermen out there right now, I know, who are trying to build businesses based on the Asian carp. And there are incentives been offered now by the state for them to build processing plants, and there's been contracts signed for them to ship millions of pounds of these fish abroad to Asia. Having looked at this from a historical perspective, I can't deny I have some concerns about that, because it seems to me we're going down the same track. As I said, common carp were initially introduced as a food fish because they were so popular in Europe. But as Americans tried them, they decided generally as a nation, obviously there are exceptions, but as a nation, they generally did not like carp. And I'm not surprised by that, given that here in America, you have native species like trout and salmon, which are highly regarded food fish. You have catfish as well. All of these are fine eating fish. Relatively speaking, carp are down the totem pole, as it were. So on the one hand, I don't want to hurt or reduce the chances of success for people who are trying to build businesses on the Asian carp. But on the other hand, I worry that, well, why, if we were wanting to build markets for fishing, why didn't we incentivize fishing for native species like the buffalo fish, which used to exist? And are Americans really going to like Asian carp when they've got all these other fishes? I give one quick anecdote. The Palmer Hotel in Chicago, a very prestigious hotel, a chef tried to offered Asian carp meals, or samplers, I guess, for 2 weeks for free in hopes of creating some interest in that. 6 months later, the Asian carp was quietly removed from the menu of that hotel. And, you know, there are lots of other examples like that. So whether or not there's an American market for Asian carp remains to be seen. Certainly there is a market for them abroad, but it does seem ironic that we have native species here that we're not really working on, but we're willing to spend a lot of money to ship them abroad.
See, what you need is a new name, because, you know, the Chilean sea bass is actually called a Patagonian toothfish. But when they change the name, it's all about marketing.
Absolutely. And there's people well ahead of me and you on that, because they've already tried to reinvent the Asian carp in terms of names. But that, again, it's been happening before. One of the other Asian carps is called grass carp. But when that was introduced, or they were considering introducing that in the 1960s, they gave that a new name called the White Amur, because they didn't want to associate grass carp with the common carp. So yes, marketing, it's all about marketing.
We're going to talk some more with our guest in just a moment. First, though, we need to take a short break. This is Focus.
In The Hangover, Bradley Cooper worked with a tiger. In The Hangover Part 2, he works with a monkey who plays a cigarette-smoking drug dealer who occasionally panicked.
Crystal would just claw into my shoulder. I was like bleeding, and I had scars, and we kept saying, "She has her shots, right?"
Bradley Cooper on the next Fresh Air, and John Powers talks about Cannes. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week. Let me just mention quickly that tomorrow we'll talk with Annie Jacobson. She is an investigative journalist and has written a new book about Area 51. This is the place that I'm sure in a lot of people's minds is associated with aliens and UFOs. It is a place that exists, although the government doesn't admit that it does. And it has been used to do top secret military research, although the UFO thing is really not what it's been all about. We'll talk about Area 51 with Annie Jacobson tomorrow. And then also tomorrow, talk about some issues that have to do with state and federal pensions. And our guest there will be Jeff Brown. He's a professor of finance at the U of I. He's been with us before on the program. We are here weekday mornings 10 to noon. You can check out the schedule and listen to past programs by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're talking about the issue of introduced species, and we've been talking very specifically about the Asian carp, but the issue really goes beyond carp, and it's more about how it is we deal with the problem of invasive, non-native, invasive plants, animals, all sorts of things. We have two guests joining us here by telephone, Reuben Keller. He's a Henry Chandler Cowles Lecturer in Environmental Studies at University of Chicago, and he's also a community ecologist who's very interested on the impacts and management of invasive species. Here in the studio with me is Glenn Sandiford. He's an environmental writer. His academic training is in urban and regional planning. He's working on a book about Asian carp and some of the questions surrounding it. And questions from people listening are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me go back here to Reuben Keller and see if you could maybe talk a little bit more about the other questions that the caller raised, because they're two different issues, but they're related. And essentially, it's that same question I asked Glenn Sandiford as well. You know, we know about how this has happened in the past, how things have been either introduced intentionally or accidentally. And so what are we doing in terms of trying to head off potential problems one way or the other?
Yeah, well, over the last several decades, ecologists, and I'm one of them who's worked on this, have come up with ways to predict which species are likely to become invasive in the future. And then we can make some educated input to policy, for example, to say that, you know, species X, which is proposed to come in the pet trade, for example, poses too high a risk of becoming invasion, and perhaps that ought to lead policymakers to prevent that species from coming in. So I think that the science of it has improved immensely over the last several decades, but that has not translated yet into policy. Unless we're looking at pests of agriculture, so these would be invasive species that affect livestock or crops, and those invasive species tend to be pretty well controlled. We're really concerned about them because we know they'll have very large economic impacts. So they tend to be pretty well controlled. There are pretty good border controls to prevent those from coming in. But almost all other species, species that come in for the pet trade, species that come in for the water garden trade, for the nursery plant trade, these come in virtually unregulated. The lists of species that are considered invasive and that can't come into the United States are extremely short, much, much shorter than the scale of the problem. And at the federal level, there's been very little action to try and get a better handle on the control of these species coming in. Some legislators have tried. There have been efforts going back to the mid and late 70s to try and do this, to implement policies that require all new species coming into the United States to be assessed for the likelihood that they'll become invasive. But over time, we've seen repeatedly that these bills in the Congress have failed. And one of the reasons that they've failed, and actually the main reason that they've failed, has been opposition from the trades that bring in these species. So you can imagine that the pet industry, the aquaculture industry, the nursery plants industry, they want to operate in a situation where they have as few regulations as possible. And they've been able to successfully mount challenges to any sort of new legislation that could restrict the species that they have available for sale. So I'm going to go back to something that Glenn said earlier, which was that the people who are introducing these species are all very well-meaning, and we shouldn't demonize them. I think that at the individual level, so at the individual retailer level or at the individual aquaculturist level, for example, that might be true. But at the whole industry level, I'm not sure that's true. For example, aquaculture, even before the 1970s, had a long history of introducing invasive species. So it's really not that surprising that another species, in this case another couple of species, what we now refer to as the Asian carps, came in and became invasive. And likewise, the pet trade and the shipping industry and the nursery garden plants industry, these industries have known for decades that some subset of the species that they introduce become invasive, cause very large impacts. But within those industries, there has been very little action to try and restrict the species that come in, so that species that are very likely to become invasive are kept out.
Let me ask you another question. I don't know how difficult it would be to answer it. There are some species here in the United States that are not native, but have been here for so long that people think they've always been here. And two things that just come to mind just right off the top of my head are the European honeybee and the pheasant. And I don't know if those are particularly good examples, but I'm thinking of things that were introduced, have been around for a long time, and seem to have found their niche and have become part of the landscape and part of the ecosystem, which raises in my mind the question is, well, why? What's the difference between something that can fit in and not become a problem and something that does become a problem?
So what you're getting at there is possibly something that Glenn can talk to better than I, but I'll take a shot.
Okay.
When we define, or when we use the word invasive, we're normally talking about species that cause more harm than benefit. So they're species that, in hindsight, we'd really rather not have. Now, of course, defining harm and benefit, those are extremely value-laden. So when we define an invasive species, we're really saying, based on our current set of values, these are the species that we would prefer not to have. So in the case of, for example, the European honeybee, they've actually become quite valuable now because they're one of the main pollinators of crops. So yes, they've been here long enough. They have some benefits, which by and large, I think people in the United States consider that those benefits outweigh the costs. So we really probably don't consider them invasive. They are non-native, but we don't consider them invasive. Whereas there are other species, and the Asian carp is one, which has these very large impacts on, for example, recreational values. So you don't want to be a water skier on the Mississippi River anymore because you don't want to hit a 40-pound carp at a high rate of speed. And those sorts of impacts we consider vastly outweigh the benefits of that species. So we call it invasive. But I think the basic message there is that we manage these ecosystems very tightly, ecosystems that have non-native species. So when we say which species are desirable and which species are not, that's kind of a very value-laden management-type assessment. And it's so it has to come, it has to be, well, it has to be recognized as coming from that perspective. It's value-laden and very difficult to scientifically define.
Okay. Well, there, maybe I don't know, Glenn wants to add something to that.
I think one thing that comes to mind there is, as you talked about the pheasant, growing up in England, I too, amongst all my farming relatives, the pheasant was a favorite quarry of the hunters among my relatives. Ironically, it's an introduced species there too. So I see in two different countries, in two different cultures, where the pheasant has been accepted and embraced. But when I did a little bit of research on that and tracked its introduction in the 1880s, again, one of the reasons it was introduced was the native species were being hunted down and becoming scarce. So it, in essence, it was a replacement. One of the reasons it was introduced was as a replacement for declining native species. But the quandary you're talking about, it plays out every day in natural resource agencies. Here in Illinois, you have natural resource agencies, you know, established to manage the natural resources of the state. On the one hand, within them, you have a division that is prioritizing native species and restoration of native ecosystems. And in a division, another division within the same agency, they're thinking of ways to market Asian carp, an invasive species like Asian carp. So there's a tension there, a policy tension, that reflects the values, the competing values, if you are. I don't know that there is no clear-cut answer, I don't think, there. But one lesson I think I would suggest that's emerged over the years is, until now, the onus has been on skeptics to prove that a species has negative impacts. I think one thing I would suggest now is that the onus shift onto proposers of introduced species somehow proving to a reasonable level that the species are not going to become invasive or harmful. Again, that's still a value decision, but I think there's a shift in values.
We're down to maybe about 5-6 minutes. I want to come back to something that Reuben Keller, you said in the first half of the program, where you said that, and again, this is specifically about the carp, about the Asian carp, where you said that on the one hand, we can't be certain what the effect would be if the carp gets into the Great Lakes. But on the other hand, if it turns out to be bad, once the proverbial, you know, we're closing the barn door after the horses have gone, that once they're there and they get established, there's not very much we can do. So that would argue for doing what we can to prevent them. At least I would think it would argue for doing what we can to prevent them from getting into the lake. So if you look at what it is we're doing there, how would you assess that effort? And in fact, is that a battle that we can win?
It's absolutely a battle that we can win if we're prepared to put the resources towards it. And the question is, well, so the question becomes, how much resources are we prepared to put at it? And what's happened so far is the Asian carp have been moving up through the Mississippi and then the Illinois River, heading towards Chicago and the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And this is the artificial canal that was dug by Illinois in the late 1800s, opened in 1900, and it connects the Chicago River to the Des Plaines River and then to the Illinois River and the Mississippi. It's an artificial canal. It crosses the Continental Divide. So ordinarily, aquatic species could not cross that divide. They could not move from the Mississippi into the Great Lakes. So to try and prevent Asian carp from getting through to the Great Lakes, the Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies as well have been erecting what are known as electric barriers in the canal. And this is basically a system of cables underneath the canal which emit electric pulses, and this is designed to try and repel the fish. Does it work? Is really the question. That's the really important question that we need to be trying to answer now. And I don't think anybody knows. These electric barriers are really an experimental technology. They haven't been used in this type of situation before. So we don't have a history of application of them to look back at and say, well, you know, yes, they work with this efficiency, or no, they don't work. And one reason to be concerned about whether or not they'll work is that the way that that the agency scientists have tried to figure out the parameters for the electric barriers is to do experiments in very confined experimental settings. So these are in tanks that are not necessarily larger than a bathtub, for example. And fish behave very differently in a bathtub than they do in a real river situation, which is what they're going to experience in the sanitary and ship canal. So I don't think, well, although those experimental results are promising, I don't think that they really answer the question of whether the electric barriers work. And there's actually some quite good evidence that they might not work. And that evidence is that we've been finding the DNA of these fishes beyond the electric barrier. Now, there are several ways that those fish might have gotten beyond the electric barrier, but I think the most likely one is that they swam through the river. It's really hard to explain that in any other way. And if they did swim through the river, that would mean that somehow they made it past the electric barriers. And it's possible that they went past a couple of years ago when the electric barriers were closed down for maintenance. That's a possibility. It's possible that small numbers of Asian carp just by chance are able to get through the barrier every now and then. We don't really know. So as yet, we don't really have a satisfactory explanation for why there is carp DNA, why there are carp beyond the barrier. But I think you've got to look very closely at whether the barrier is working now that we know that now that we know that carp are living beyond the barrier.
Well, that's I'm glad we got to this point because this did get some attention certainly last year when this discovery was made that there was in fact carp DNA on the other side of the barrier. And so what I hear you saying is that does in fact mean that there are carp, that it's not just somehow, I don't know how that would happen, that genetic material would be there. But if the genetic material is there, that means that the fish are also there? Or is that not certain?
To my mind, it's completely certain. All right. We can put people in jail for their life based on the trail of DNA evidence that they leave behind at crime scenes, for example. And in that case, we're identifying people as individuals. That's quite tricky compared to the problem of just identifying organisms at a species level genetically. If there's DNA there, it's really, really hard to explain how that DNA got there without there being actual fish, especially given that the DNA has turned up repeatedly in many of the tests that have been conducted.
Okay. You want to add something to that, Glenn?
Yeah, I think I would. There are different perceptions of certainty. I'm inclined to agree with Ruben's view of whether or not there are Asian carp that have got past the barriers. But in this controversy, my opinion doesn't count. What counts, for example, in the lawsuit that was really recently filed by Michigan was, does the judge and does the legal system recognize that certainty? And so far, they haven't. And I think that's an interesting point again here. What one person views as a certainty or as an unacceptable risk is not necessarily shared by someone else. But I think what, to me, the more important question or the deeper question is, there's potential for profound impacts in the Great Lakes if these Asian carp do get into the Great Lakes. We can stop them. We can stop them in that canal. There are other entryways too, but we can certainly stop them getting through the canal. Do we have the political will to invest in measures that will stop them? Again, getting back to the deeper question, since we're talking about not just Asian carp, but introduced species as a whole, there's a wonderful book published in 1996 by Edward Tenner called The Revenge of Unintended Consequences that looks at how nature unpredictably behaved after it was utilized in certain ways. And I think that's a wonderful book for people who are interested in this subject. I would leave people with this closing thought. If 30 years ago I had said to people who were proposing introduction of Asian carp, you shouldn't introduce the Asian carp because these fish are going to be jumping out of the water by the thousands and hitting people in the head and knocking them off jet skis, knocking kayakers out of races, would I have been laughed out of the room? And would that been offered? Would that have been accepted as credible evidence? We just don't know. But based on the evidence already accumulated with Asian carp, they have the potential to have profound and serious impacts.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think at that point we're going to have to stop with the promise that it's a story that we will continue to follow and perhaps can talk about again. We want to say thanks to our guest joining us by telephone, Reuben Keller. He's a lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Chicago. He's a community ecologist who is particularly interested on the impacts and management of invasive species. And Dr. Keller, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Here in studio, Glenn Sandford. He is a graduate of U of I, has a PhD in urban and regional planning. And perhaps at some point when you write this new book, the book that you're working on looking at the issue of Asian carp, we'll talk about it.
I'd be delighted to come back. Thanks for having me.
All right, thank you.